Hey, it's Benjamin. Thanks so much for tuning in to People Place Power. Trisha and I made this episode back when we were living in Colorado last October, and so we'll be trying something a bit different this week. We hope you enjoy the show, and don't forget to follow us and leave a review on Apple Podcasts if you like what you hear.
Picture this. It's a frigid January night in the Rocky Mountains of Colorado. Snow swirls around you as if you're in a snow globe. Temperatures plunge below zero, and the ground is blanketed in 5 feet of snow. You're in the middle of nowhere, the only person for miles around. Everything around you is so white, you can't tell which way is up and which way is down. Suddenly, you see a light. And then you hear Bollywood music? At this point, you think you're hallucinating, but it turns out you've stumbled upon the house of the one and only permanent resident of an abandoned silver mining town. His name is Billy.
It's Billy. He lives by himself, and for 9-10 months of the year, he sees hardly anybody and does that on purpose.
He's obsessed with chocolate.
He makes an annual trip to the factory outlet store for Russell Stover chocolates. He brings back about 30, 40, 50 pounds of chocolate.
And from his solitary residence in the mountains, Billy has fundamentally shaped our understanding of climate change. The best part? It was totally by accident.
Welcome to People Place Power, where we explore big questions around activism through the eyes of changemakers around the world. I'm Trisha Mukherjee.
And I'm Benjamin Swift. Today's story is about someone I've known for a long time. He's really a legend in my hometown, both for his offbeat personality and for his role as an unlikely contributor to climate science.
My name's Billy Barr. I have no idea what I do, tell you the truth.
That's Billy. By the way, he spells his name with no capital letters, small B-I-L-L-Y, small B-A-R-R.
So who is Billy?
You know, he's a really memorable character. He has a long white beard, wears a gothic cricket club hat, can tell you the genealogy of every single Bollywood star that's ever lived. I've always known him as this joyful, kind of eccentric man who lives in an off-the-grid house in a ghost town called Gothic. It's a 20-minute drive from where I grew up.
Okay, so Billy's basically the only non-ghost living in this ghost town?
Exactly. So Gothic sits in the shadow of Gothic Mountain, a giant mountain whose name was inspired by Gothic cathedrals. Billy's the only person who's continuously lived year-round in Gothic.
For how long?
He's lived there for 48 consecutive years.
It's pretty overwhelming. I mean, there's this big mountain right in front of you, and you know, it's wide open.
Has he lived completely alone at the base of Gothic Mountain this entire time?
Billy, he lives by himself, and for 9-10 months of the year, he sees hardly anybody and does that on purpose.
That's Dr. Bobby Pekarsky. She's a stream ecologist at the Rocky Mountain Biological Laboratory in Gothic, pronounced RMBL or Rumble.
Billy is the soul of the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab.
Wait, Billy has friends? I thought he lived alone in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, he's actually the accountant at Rumble, which is a research station in the former silver mining town of Gothic. A lot of people would consider Gothic to be a ghost town, and it pretty much is in the winter. But in the summer, it's brimming with scientists and students from all over the world. Some people think Billy's reclusive because he lives alone in Gothic through the winter when all the scientists are gone. And it's true that in the winters, he's all alone. But in the summer, he sees people all the time through his job. Every morning, Bobby and her students stop by Billy's office to grab chocolate.
And then we would get chocolate because he has 47 little tins of chocolate. And we'd load up our pockets and go out in the field with Billy Barr chocolate. And if we had that as our start of our day, it was a good day.
So it's a way of getting to know people is to bribe them. You know, sometimes it's the only way I can get anybody to talk to me.
Billy says he uses chocolate as a bribe to get people to socialize with him. But in reality, going to eat Billy's chocolate is really just an excuse for people to hang out with him.
Yeah, it seems like Billy's been social distancing for most of his life in Gothic.
Right. A lot of people have turned to him during the pandemic to seek advice on how to socially distance. Mm-hmm. NPR published an article on Billy called Tips from Someone with Nearly 50 Years of Social Distancing Experience. And a few other outlets also wrote about his socially distanced life. But there are even more articles about how his citizen science has shaped climate research.
So how did Billy, a chocolate-loving, Bollywood-watching, permanently social-distancing modern-day hermit, with his quirks and his isolated lifestyle, help develop a foundational understanding of climate science?
I think to answer that question, we have to go back to the beginning.
So Billy has always lived in Gothic, right?
Nope. Even though Billy is the only permanent resident in Gothic, he wasn't born there. He actually spent the first part of his life somewhere very different across the country.
I grew up in Trenton, New Jersey. I was in New York all the time as a kid. I was kind of negative on who I was in that environment.
Right.
And out here, I was just on my own. I mean, it was obvious from the first day for me that this was an environment I felt like I would be much more healthy in.
Yeah, I live pretty close to Trenton, and I'd say it's the opposite of a ghost town.
In New Jersey, Billy was a student at Rutgers University, where he was studying biology. He first came out to Gothic to work at Rumble as a college student.
It was just the solitude. It was the fact that I just wanted to get away, get on my own, and it was a very, you know, it's a very nice environment.
Right.
You just were on your own. It was easy to do things without being judged or being judged by myself, really.
And he loved it immediately.
At the end of the summer, Billy had to return to New Jersey to finish school. But as soon as he could, he moved back to Gothic, this time for good, and started working as a librarian for RMBL. After that, he worked in a bunch of different roles for Rumble, and eventually became their business manager.
I wonder what it was like for Billy to move from the most densely populated state in the U.S., to ghost town.
It must have been a crazy transition, but it gets even better. When Billy moved to Gothic in 1972, he started off living in a tent.
What?
Eventually, though, he upgraded to an abandoned 8x10-foot mining shack.
Uh-huh.
No one really knew who the shack belonged to, so Billy just took up residence. Mm-hmm. It wasn't luxurious by any means. It was actually quite the opposite. There was no running water, no heat, and no insulation to protect Billy from the freezing temperatures outside.
I mean, it had no window. I mean, it had a window, but the window was gone.
Right.
And so I had to put plastic on it, and it was just a thin one-by siding, no insulation or anything. And then when I came back the next year, I insulated the ceiling with one-inch styrofoam. That's about it. But yeah, that made a huge difference.
His friend Bobby, who we heard from earlier, described a trip to his Gothic cabin to me.
I skied out to see him in 1977, and I actually stayed in that freezing cold little cabin for two nights. It's the coldest I've ever been in my whole life, Benjamin. Oh my God. He had a big vat of water that he got from the Billy Spring, and in the morning it was frozen, solid.
So does Billy live in that same mining shack today?
No, so after living there for 8 years, Billy built his own house with the help of two friends. It's off the grid, it has solar panels and big south-facing windows, it even has a movie theater inside. Now he lives in comfort and arguably maybe even style.
So now that Billy lives in his fully insulated house in Gothic, what does he do all day?
He has a very specific schedule.
So I lay in bed till 5 o'clock and then get on the computer till 7. And do the weather. I usually do the weather at about 6:40 and then go back out again at about 6:30. And I eat breakfast, take my time, and I go down to the lab and work. I go for a ski after work. I have these little loops and take my binoculars and I knit a little bit. I watch a movie every night and then after the movie, go to bed. And so it's pretty regular.
You might be wondering why I just spent all this time describing the intricacies of Billy's solitary lifestyle to you.
Yeah.
Well, clearly Billy lives a life that's different from most of ours. Instead of grabbing coffee on the way to work, Billy grabs his thermometer to measure the freshly fallen snow. And instead of sitting in traffic for hours, He sits outside with binoculars, recording the bird species that fly by. And it's precisely because of his patient and secluded lifestyle that he's had such a profound impact on climate science. So you know how Billy mentioned that he does the weather every day?
Yeah.
When Billy moved to Gothic and was living in his freezing cold cabin, he had a lot of free time to do whatever he wanted. So just to pass the time, Billy spent around an hour every morning with a ruler, a clipboard, and a scale, measuring the snow on the ground.
He measured snow just to pass the time?
Yeah, well, there's not too much going on in a ghost town, so yeah, just to pass the time.
And how exactly did he measure the snow?
Well, here's Billy.
To start with, I did things that were very simple, which was measuring the amount of new snow. I needed a ruler and a board. Measuring the depth, I needed a pole with markings on it. The temperature, the minimum and maximum each day, I just needed a maximum thermometer.
And with these simple tools that he had lying around, Billy measured a ton of different variables. Every day, he measured the height and water content of the snow, the maximum and minimum temperatures, every single winter storm and avalanche, and how animal populations fluctuate as the seasons change. And then he recorded all of these numbers very meticulously in stacks and stacks of notebooks in his house.
And he still does this every single day?
Yep.
For how many years?
Every single day for 48 years. Just for his own entertainment.
No way.
And not only that, he records a lot of other data.
Billy mentioned to me that he also had a record of a number of other events, including when he saw the first marmot in the spring, or when he heard the first broad-tailed hummingbird male fly by. Or
that's David Inouye.
I'm a retired professor from the University of Maryland, and this is my 50th year working here at the Rocky Mountain Biological Lab.
David's a world-renowned ecologist who studies pollination and plant phenology.
What's phenology?
Phenology is the study of the timing of biological life cycles of plants and animals.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah, so David's kind of a big shot at Rumble and in the ecology world.
Uh-huh. Okay, and so how does David come into the story?
David and Billy have been friends for decades, and they met when Billy came to Gothic for the first time as a student. Here's David again.
He was a little shy, a little socially awkward, very interested in science.
As both David and Billy continued their work around Rumble over the years, David came to realize that the shy, socially awkward librarian might be more than he seemed. In fact, he might hold the key to something groundbreaking. All these years, David had been collecting data on plant and pollinator life cycles, and he suspected that they might be shifting due to human-caused climate change. Yet, there was a hole in his research. He didn't have long-term data on weather patterns, snowfall, and animal emergence timings to explain why he was seeing these changes. But someone did. Billy, who had been measuring the weather and snow every single morning, year after year.
Just for fun.
So with Billy's permission, David combined their data sets to yield one of the world's most comprehensive and long-term data sets, showing how and why the warming climate is impacting plants and animals.
David Inouye has been doing phenology for the same length of time that I've been doing weather. He was able to take that data, look at what's happened with his plants, and see if there was a correlation between things like number of days of snow on the ground, when there's the first bare ground, how much snow there was, how much water there was. And he was able to correlate changes in the plants with that.
And that was a unique enough data set and a new enough use of those kinds of data that we were pretty easily able to get it published in a prestigious scientific journal.
So when David received a National Science Foundation grant for his phenology work, Billy was the logical choice to be a co-principal investigator because Billy's weather data was so integral to David's research. This was just one of several papers David has published with the help of Billy's data, and these conclusions have been used to inform climate policy in the Rocky Mountains and beyond.
Right. David's research has been cited over 19,000 times.
Yeah, another Rumble ecologist, John Hart, has also cited Billy's data and authored an amicus brief for the Supreme Court case, Massachusetts versus the Environmental Protection Agency, in order to provide expert testimony on the effects of climate change.
The Chief Justice has indicated that this is a summary of an opinion for the court by Justice Stevens. A group of states, local governments, and private organizations petitioned the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, to regulate emissions of four greenhouse gases, including carbon dioxide. They called global warming the most pressing environmental challenge of our time.
Yeah, Massachusetts versus EPA was a landmark court case. Basically, the court decided to force the EPA to uphold the Clean Air Act. And now the EPA has to acknowledge the climate warming caused by carbon dioxide. And most importantly, the EPA has to work to mitigate that warming.
Yep.
And what did David, using Billy's data, conclude about climate change?
So it's complicated, but David told me.
The bottom line is that the snow is melting earlier than it used to.
And why does that matter?
If the snow melts earlier, then the life cycles of flowering plants and their pollinators are completely disrupted.
Mm-hmm.
If flower life cycles are disrupted, then their pollinators, like bees, aren't able to pollinate or find food to survive. If pollinators aren't thriving, it's a big deal. Pollinators are necessary for producing one out of every 3 to 4 bites of food we eat.
So Billy, who measured snow just to pass the time while living in solitude, has been essential to our understanding of climate change.
Exactly.
So this is incredible because if Billy hadn't done this, we never would have had this data set. If scientists had only just realized that it's urgent to measure these variables now, in 2020, there's no way we could have gone back and gathered the data from the 1970s. Instead, we would have had to collect it over the next few decades.
By the time we'd see long-term trends, it would already be way too late.
Mm-hmm. It's only because Billy has been doing it all this time that we're able to see how urgent climate change is at this very moment.
Right. And David also told me about how hard it is to collect data over such an extended period of time as a quote-unquote official scientist.
Why? Aren't the scientists in the academy the ones with all the funding and power and everything?
Well, here's David.
A typical grant from the National Science Foundation is for 2 or 3 years. And at the end of those 2 or 3 years, you hope that you have enough information to have a cohesive, comprehensive story that you can tell in a publication. So 8 years of data, which would take 2 or 3 NSF grants typically to get, you'd think you'd really have a great story. But if I just compare those 8 years to the other, let's say, 42 years in a 50-year data set, it tells a very different story than the longer-term data set does. And so that helps to make the point that even with 8 years of data, which for an ecological study is a long time, you may get what turns out to be a mistaken impression. And that really confirms the value of the kinds of long-term research that go on up here at RNBL. Some of the conclusions that we're drawing now, I think I have a fair amount of confidence saying, well, here's 47 years of data, and here's what the story tells us.
This is where Billy and you and I come in.
How?
Well, the answer is citizen science. If everyday people like us pay attention to our environments, just like Billy, we'll start to notice patterns or provide data for scientists to document patterns in order to better understand how our world is changing.
And citizen science is accessible and democratizing. Anyone can spend a few minutes a day observing their surroundings and using those findings to promote evidence-based change in their communities. You don't need to spend years getting a PhD to make an impact as a citizen scientist. You don't even need any formal education.
And Bobby, Billy's friend and colleague, actually thinks that in some ways, it's even better to not be confined by the walls of the academy.
Children are great observers, and then we teach it out of them.
Right.
We don't let them keep doing that, you know, and so I think that citizens, you don't want to give them too many rules and let them be kind of unaffected by the rigors of the training that you're supposed to have to be an ecologist. I think they're probably better in general, better observers because they have an open mind, a completely open mind.
So Billy's done some really cool work, and like Bobby says, not having a PhD can actually be a strength, not a weakness. But I was living in New York this summer, where the natural environment is deeply impacted by humans. And now I'm a full-time student. I don't exactly have the time to move to a cabin and document the weather for 48 years. But I can still be a citizen scientist. To explore the idea of citizen science, let's look to a few different places in the world.
First stop,
Tanzania in the year 1960. On the shores of Lake Tanganyika, a woman sits alongside her shabby camp staring at a chimpanzee. The chimp stares back. This woman is Jane Goodall, the most famous naturalist on Earth. When 26-year-old Jane arrived in Tanzania, she had no formal background or education in science, not even an undergraduate degree. She just loved nature. But while in Tanzania, Jane observed the chimps day after day, year after year.
Just as Billy observed the snow.
Exactly.
She watched as chimps created tools out of grass and used these tools to hunt for termites. Before, scientists believed that humans' use of tools set us apart from any other species. But Jane, an amateur naturalist and citizen scientist with so much curiosity, changed our entire view of who we are as humans.
Second stop,
Aberdeen Country Park in Hong Kong. Butterflies flutter through the lush forests and rugged mountains above the iconic Hong Kong skyline. So far, we've only talked about individuals, Billy Barr and Jane Goodall, as impactful citizen scientists. But a lot of the most important citizen science these days doesn't come from people who spend their lives doing it. It comes from busy people with day jobs who have a few minutes every day to contribute, like citizens in urban areas like Hong Kong. Every day, people can just snap a picture of a flower, a tree, or an animal and upload it to an app like iNaturalist. Then, experts use these crowdsourced photos and observations as data on the organisms they study. For instance, a group of biologists in Hong Kong used iNaturalist data to determine that with the progression of climate change, conservation areas like Aberdeen Park were becoming less and less effective in their goals of preserving tropical butterflies. iNaturalist allowed these researchers to access and analyze data that would have been difficult or impossible for them to collect on their own.
Last stop,
the California coast. Usually it's bright and sunny, but more and more, Californians have seen the skies filled with smoke from nearby wildfires.
In San Francisco, the smoke clouds your vision and stings your nostrils. But you can see the exact severity of the air pollution from anywhere in the world using the website Purple Air, an affordable air quality monitoring system. Basically, you can order this device that's the size of a coffee mug, install it on your house, and automatically upload air quality data to the cloud so that school districts, governments, and even other people can have access to high-resolution air quality information.
And these are all privately purchased. There are people contributing the data just for the public good.
That's RJ Honecke, a director of engineering at Toronto Wireless. RJ studies wearable technologies and participatory urbanism. He told us that the Purple Air device costs around $200, way cheaper than many government-installed monitors.
It's way more useful and accurate than the EPA version, even though the California Air Board or whatever is spending upwards of $100,000 on their sensors and so forth.
In essence, Purple Air puts data collection back into the hands of the people. This makes data collection cheaper, more efficient, and more thorough. In addition, technology like Purple Air is passive citizen science. You don't have to observe chimpanzees like Jane Goodall or pull out your phone to snap a photo for iNaturalist. Using this technology, you can be a citizen scientist without even thinking about it. RJ believes that accessible technology can actually help promote environmental justice. When companies dump waste and pollution in communities that are often cash poor or communities of color, the companies don't face consequences. This is because there is no funding for research and data collection in these communities. But new technologies like Purple Air, though they're only just being developed, can empower citizens to document the negative environmental and health impacts of polluting companies. Then they can demand accountability.
Because they're the people consuming the data, they know very well oftentimes what kind of data they need in order to make good decisions.
What citizen science really does is put the power of data back into the hands of the people. Citizen science can be a lifelong passion project, some photos you take on your walk home from work, or even something as simple as passively monitoring environmental health in your neighborhood.
And all you have to do to be a citizen scientist is put on your jacket, walk out the door, and just observe.
And who knows? You might just become the next Billy Barr.
And now for our credits. This podcast was created on Ute Land in Colorado.
Andrew Dewey composed our theme music. Karen Jansen and Kevin Donovan performed the music you hear now.
Jesse Sheldon designed our cover art, and Nick Bluebird Lane designed our episode art. Nina Durga designed our website, and Metzli Nieves administered our social media.
And a special thanks to Milan Terlunen, Mari McCarville, and Elliot Williams for all their support and feedback as we created our first ever episode.
I'm Benjamin Swift.
I'm Tricia McCurdy. And thank you for listening to People, Place, Power. If you liked what you heard today, be sure to follow and rate the show. You can also follow us on Instagram at People, Place, Power and email us your thoughts at hello@peopleplacepower.com. See you in 2 weeks with our next episode.